Alan Kring Productions, in association with the Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. As I had said in the message I sent out yesterday, there was some concern that we were going to get inclement weather, and I had a couple of students complaining that I was possibly putting students in danger. And of course, as it's turned out, it's nothing around here. But I put it out so that we can have the quiz on Friday, and then there will be an attendance quiz next week. And then we'll be cleaning up the rest of the course and going on with our lives here. Next week is, by the way, not in the textbook. There will be supporting materials in your resources tab for what's coming next week. The Federal Reserve and ethics will be the topics. And like I said, there will be resources for you, but these are not textbook subjects. Today, project analysis, one last round. I froze there for a second because this is sort of a cleanup kind of part of chapter 12. I cover some terminology and a couple of unusual cases that go on. Before we do that, though, a quick look at the numbers is always in order. It's always fun, or something like that. Now, we have had a bold day here. It's definitely picked up some steam, and there have been a couple of surges in this one. As the Dow is up 63.63%, and the S&P 500, of course, if it's an up day, the S&P 500 is usually going to be up more than the Dow, and it's up 0.84%. And then we've got the NASDAQ just tearing up the walls at 1.75% up. Great news. On the other hand, of course, we have crude oil that's making it back above $100 a barrel. It wants so bad to get some daylight from 100, and it will as time goes on. The general sentiment is that there was definitely a decrease in the price of oil, largely because of the strategic oil reserve getting a million barrels released. Other reserves were getting released too to bring down the price, to calm down political anger. And there was also a lot of oil is still coming out of Russia and through legitimate or illegitimate means that it's getting out. However, those reserves that were released and are being released, that's a finite thing. And that's why now that extra surge of supply brought the price of oil down. But now that that supply has come through and the expectation is that there's not going to be more of that, well, the price is going to find its way back up. On the other hand, the oil coming out of Russia still seems to be flowing, but there is kind of a small sentiment that we're getting close to a crucial point in Russia's latest misadventure. And so that might cause less of their oil to show up on the high seas. But going over here, gold and silver are both showing signs of life. And the bonds yields are down, good, 5 basis points. So the price of bonds is up. So investors are buying bonds, they're buying metal, and they're buying equities. So that would mean that there is money being shaken out from cash reserves, and it's just going into every place it can. More risk-averse investors going to metals and bonds, more risk-preferring investors going into equities and some bonds. And so you have what appears to be a general happy mood with some cash coming out to do this. Look at the S&P 500, though, just to see. Well, it's not very spectacular. I mean, the volume is still really weak compared to overall over the past 52 weeks on a daily basis. But, you know, we'll take our happy times as we can on this. And on the other side of the world, well, crap. Oh, quit it. Stop it. Ads everywhere. Okay, on the other side of the world, London seemed to bounce positive, and then it had a negative thing, but it finished up, and the Nikkei finished up too. So there is seems to be some kind of a bullish sentiment kind of moving around out there these days. I don't know how long it'll last, but there is a general expectation that we'll have a recession starting probably in the first quarter of next year. And from there, we'll see what goes. Anyway, let me take you on a couple of journeys here. And a lot of this is sort of like cleanup work. And I've got an Excel, new Excel sheet up in your resources tab. It's called Common Life. Common Life. And it's the Excel sheet I'm going to show you today. But before I do that, there is, if you might notice that the book kind of shifts terminology here in chapter 12 over what it had used for the same terms before. Now, as a general rule, this is more of a modern term anyway, is this term standalone risk. Up to this point in the textbook, that meant the overall volatility of returns of a stock. The overall volatility of returns of a stock. In other words, if you buy just Apple, you're going to be in for a wild ride. Its volatility is crazy. But then there was that market risk. That is a risk that is there after you have diversified away all of the standalone risk, the peculiar risk. Okay, so now, in this chapter, chapter 12, they make a middle ground right here. The authors say, well, standalone risk, when you're looking at projects, yes or no, go or no go, the standalone risk is the risk just of that project. And then they put in this new one here, the corporate risk, which used to be, which in previous chapters was called standalone risk. The risk just of that company. All of its projects taken together. And then, of course, this market risk is the one, the non-diversifiable. It's still the same one. This is the risk of the stock in a well-diversified portfolio. Non-diversifiable, systemic, etc. That's the one that remains even when you put the stock in with a bunch of other stocks, so they're canceling out each other's peculiar risk. Now, this standalone risk takes on this meaning only when you're talking about a project in a company. If you're not talking about new projects, if you're just talking about the company's risk, that's standalone risk in a larger context. A project on its own is actually quite risky. And if you're in a corporate world, which most of you are going to get jobs in corporations, and at some point you'll see a larger picture. At first they're going to have you doing something, you know, some very focused task, and then they'll expand you from there. And as time goes on, you will begin to see the risk of the larger corporate company. But you probably will see the risk of a project first. And sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. But keep in mind that projects can really take a nasty turn, so we have to be as careful as we can. That's why we do this incremental cash flow analysis, and we do make sure that we're using the right discount rate and all of that kind of stuff, is because once you've committed to it, I mean, your neck is on the line, and it can turn out to be a disaster. And let me give you a couple of good examples of that. I may have gone through these before, or at least some of them, but a quick example, Coca-Cola, old, venerable, strong company, actually very conservative in its choices of what to do next, how to manage its asset portfolio and its project portfolio in a way that lowers its risk as much as possible. So, for example, many years ago, Coca-Cola moved from doing its own bottling to its kind of semi-outsourcing the bottling to other companies, to bottling enterprises, bottling company and all that. They might have had the Coca-Cola label, but they were definitely cabined, as it were, separately. But then Coca-Cola, in the 1980s, decided that it was getting too stale, too boring. And so it went on a very risky idea called New Coke. They were going to redesign the formula of Coke. And it was dramatic what they did. Now, in focus groups, and they did this analysis, essentially what we're doing here, kind of a lot bigger sheets and more impressive, but it was this, and they did focus groups, you know, the marketing stuff, you know, having taste testing, and they found out that this new Coke formula was preferred to the old Coke formula. It was still a Coke, it tasted like Coke, but it had a little bit bolder taste and all of that. And so they went straight to the wall with it. They just pulled the old Coke, and they put new Coke on the shelves, and it just pissed off their entire consumer base. Pretty much everyone hated new Coke. It was a disaster, and it cost the company a huge amount of money. You know, that cash flow analysis where you got the free cash flow negative at the beginning and then all these wonderful growing positives. Well, they had these massive positives on those FCF lines 1, 2, 3, 4 years out. Didn't happen. Sales just went spiraling downward. Why? Well, wait a minute. Didn't the focus groups find out that people loved the new Coke? Yes, they did. And even after they introduced it, they went back and said, okay, what was wrong with those? They hired a new analysis group to see what was flawed about the original focus groups. No, the new groups found a new Coke in blind taste tests. They found it to be much better than the old Coke. What was the problem? Coca-Cola was an old company. People wanted Coke. They didn't want new. The word new actually had a psychogenic effect on people's perception of the taste of it. Once they heard it was new, blah. If they didn't know it was new, yeah. So there you go. What a catastrophe that was. Now I'll take you to another example here. Okay, so again, even big companies can do new projects and they get their butts kicked on them. Example number two, McDonald's. And I apologize if I've told you these before, but now's where I need to focus on these. McDonald's, long ago in a galaxy far, far away, in the 1980s, I think this was. This might have been the early 90s. McDonald's decided that they were going to do something really dramatically new on their menu. They weren't going to replace anything, but they were going to put a new thing on their menu that they had, no one would ever have thought to do it. It was a pizza, not a pizza. They would have personal size pizzas and they would have family size pizzas. And let me tell you, they were delicious. I mean, they were good. Some of the best I had ever tasted, and they were very popular. Well, okay, they did a test market on them. They had a McDonald's that they did everything in, and they just tested them on the customers coming into this McDonald's. And so they retooled a very large number of their stores with the new pizza ovens, with the new supply chain additions to get the pizza ingredients in, train the employees on making the pizzas and all of this good stuff. And of course, people really liked them. So this wasn't like Coke. This was McDonald's pizza, McPizza. Yeah, this is good. Well, the problem was that people started coming through the drive-thru, and obviously, pizza's good. Everyone want McPizza? Yeah, yeah. So they ordered these family-sized pizzas through the drive-thru. Problem one, they didn't think that the drive-thru windows could not fit the family-sized pizzas through the window. They had to turn them, fold them. They ruined them. Every one of those stores had to be retooled. It wasn't in the original negative free cash flow. It was something that they realized after they had gone full on to do it. They had to open, expand the drive-through windows. Second problem was that to make a pizza is not the same as having hamburgers on ready to go, or it takes 2 minutes to make a burger. It was going to take a while. You can't inventory the burgers out there on the hot because the pizza won't taste good. So they had to make them all from scratch, and of course, or at least very, not keep very many on the line. And of course, then they had to have people pulling forward, pull forward, pull forward. And they had no parking lot designed to handle all those cars waiting for their McPizzas and getting upset and being waiting and waiting for their food. An absolute catastrophe. Retooled, which they had taken account for in year zero, negative free cash flow. Training, they had taken care of in negative free cash flow year zero. Supply expansion of the refrigeration and all that, all there, except that they didn't take into account what happens after the sale, and that was a disaster. So again, new projects can turn into absolute fiascos, catastrophes, when you don't think of everything that's going in. So when you get in there into a business environment, whether you're in marketing or not, think, everyone needs to think independently. You can't have that group mentality where, yeah, yeah, everyone says it's great. I think it's great too. Don't be a jerk about it, but at the same time, think about what is hitting you as wrong with a project. That's the numbers. I can do numbers with you all day long, but what is those numbers? What is behind those numbers is always crucial to success. There are many marketing campaigns that have been a disaster, and where you do a marketing campaign and it turns out that everyone hates you. Well, that can happen, okay? But at the same time, you got to think about what might happen if you, even if everyone's on the same page and everyone's agreeing this is a great idea. And also, be careful of fads. A couple of examples on the fad level. Gillette, just 2 years ago, it went on a marketing campaign that was attempting to go with the new trend of everyone being very inclusive and very, you know, open to different ideas. And so they started going after the men who were their traditional customers and giving them a sense that they were being, there was an effeminacy to them. And the person thing about shaving, the male thing about shaving, is not going to like that, and the marketing campaign was a disaster. Another one, many, many years ago. Japan has always been a sexist country. That's just how it has been. And to this day, to a large extent, it still is. But they saw that there was, in the United States, a movement toward less gender discrimination, more opportunities that they needed to look at for women in the workplace, women in professional roles. And this was in the early 80s. So what they did was that they thought, well, we're going to make a car and do a marketing campaign for the American woman of the 80s, bold, on the move, ready to go forward with life, in control of her own destiny. They made the car, and you know, do you know what they called the car? They called it the Toyota QT. Yeah, that worked out. Not. You see, think before you go attacking numbers on an Excel spreadsheet. Use your head and think about what you're doing. Is it meaningful? Is it right? Does it include all the possible things that can go wrong? Even then, your project can go really south on you fast. So risk is real in a project. When I look at this standalone risk as risk just of the project, it is really a stupid idea to use the weighted average cost of capital of the company. Really a stupid idea. It is also probably a stupid idea to find the betas of a bunch of companies that do just this project and use those and the CAPM to find the discount rate to use for the future expected cash flows. You are not considering all of the risk of any new project out there. You still have to do it. That's how we move forward. But recognize that the corporate landscape is littered far more with failures than it is successes. That's just the reality of it. Enough of that. I want to show you one last thing about mutually exclusive projects. And this applies to projects where you can do one thing or the other. It also has a lot to do with replacement projects. Well, we can stick with what we have now, or we can go to a whole new technology, and that would be the replacement. And then you look at the savings and free cash flows, and I've got an example of that that is just hot right now. But let me go through this first. Mutually exclusive projects can sometimes be not quite as obvious as you would think they are. You look at the NPV of both of them, whichever one has the higher NPV, that's the go. You can't choose both of them. Okay, so that's fine. So let me take up here, and like I said, this spreadsheet is right there in your resources tab in VeggieNet. Okay, here we go. Now here is a problem because you have two mutually exclusive projects, but they don't have the same life. Consider that project B would be more of a transitional technology. And so you would have to end the project sooner than you would if you went with project A, okay? This could equally apply to replacement projects. Hell, we can keep going forward with existing internal combustion, fossil fuel-powered engines for decades to come. Anything that we do to replace it is not going to last decades. I'll tell you that right now. It's a good example is, you see all these beautiful wind turbines out here on the prairie? They're gorgeous. You know what? Those will be moving in about 15 years. They'll be gone. Why? Because the winds on the prairie are dying down as global climate change picks up. The winds will die down to a speed that will not drive the turbines. So we have to recognize that any technology has a finite life, and new technologies quite often have a shorter life than the existing technologies do. So you have to take that into account. So here we're seeing two projects. Project A has a 6-year life. Project B has only a 3-year life. Now, if we take these as simply the NPV at a discount rate of 8%, we see that Project A is going to obviously be the one we choose. It has a higher net present value of future expected cash flows at an 8% discount rate. The problem is that that's not really a good way to look at them because they don't have the same life, so they don't have the same full NPV profile. The profile of this one here is a much more limited profile than the Project A. So how do we deal with lives that are unequal in mutual exclusive projects? Now, this is the way it's done. This is best practices. You do what's called common life. You look at which one is the longer life project. That would be the Project A. It has a 6-year life. So how would we make Project B look like Project A as far as life goes? Well, the easiest way and the best way is to say, well, we'll just do Project B again. When its life ends at 3 years, year three, we'll just take the project over one more time. So this is where we get into and we talk about common life of Project B. We're going to turn Project B into two consecutive cycles of the same project. So that means that the common life of Project B, the first year, it will just be Project B. The second year of the common life would be the second year of Project B. The third year, the first year would be, then the second year would be this Project B's second year of life. But in year three, we're going to do the project over again. Now remember, in year three, it still has $5,000 of positive free cash flow, but we're still going to have to spend $30,000 again. So the net will be $25,000 to do it, to start it again. It's still got $5,000 on the first round, and then we're going to throw the $30,000 at it, so we'll have a negative free cash flow in year three for Project B of $5,000 minus spending the $30,000 to start it over again. And then, well, it's going to be the same project as it was before, so year four will be year one, year five will be year two, and year six will be year three. Oh my, look at that. Now when you do the net present value of the common life Project B, it's better than Project A. At first you would have said, no, B is, we go with A. But if you look at Project B and say, well, let's just do Project B twice, it actually turns out to be a better project than Project A. Kind of an odd little twist there, isn't it? Now, here's another thing. Suppose that you're not an NPV fan. You're an internal rate of return fan. Okay. Well, let's look at the IRRs of these two projects. Now, here's something interesting. If you look at the internal rates of return, Project B actually has a higher IRR than Project A. And that, unfortunately, can actually be something that you see happen with short-term projects. They can actually have pretty darn impressive internal rates of return. Be careful of that, because you see so much of your cash flow is loaded in such a compact place that it can actually make the IRR look really attractive. Okay, fine, whatever. Well, so we go with Project B if we use IRR. Not necessarily. What if we look at the common life internal rate of return? Now remember, for common life internal rate of return, you're going to need a financing rate, the discount rate, and you're also going to need a financing rate. So we'll say that a reinvestment. We got the financing rate is still the 8%, and we have a reinvestment rate of 12%. Okay, what is the you see, we can't use a normal IRR because you've got that negative cash flow there in the middle. Switch its sign more than once. Okay, let's look at the modified internal rate of return of Project B. Well, surely it'll be a good number, won't it? Yeah, it's even better. And that one is a more realistic one because it's not a compact, it's not a short-term project. You're looking at the same project twice. And at that rate, 10.28% for the modified internal rate of return, look up here. Your financing rate is only 8%. Project B is damn good. It is a really strong project. And I don't... Even though the internal rate of return of the original Project B was good, I can't trust that because it's such a short one compared to a short life compared to the Project A. But if I look at it on a common life basis, the modified internal rate of return is absolutely yes. This is a go. This is definitely a go project at that. last pointer on this, and I'll stop beating this one to death. But let's say that we, now here's how sensitivity analysis works. You change one line at a time in your free cash flow analysis. Change the revenues, see what happens. Change your costs, see what happens. And also change the discount rate and see what happens. At, let's say, for let's get these back off the board. Well, no, let's leave it here. Let's say that we go to a 9% discount rate. Project B is still surviving. Do you see this? That tells us, and that's that fancy word, Project B is more robust to the discount rate. It is less sensitive. So Project B is still a winner, even if we have a full increase of 1% in the discount rate. And like I said, you can change other numbers, the revenues of the two when you're doing the free cash flows for those numbers in there. But it is not wrong. It is definitely a good idea to say, what if? This strengthens your hand. If you are going to be one of the people who sells a new project to your company, to go in not just with a single discount rate, to go in, let's look at what happens in this scenario. And let's look at in different ways. And I mean, you can blow the hell out of people by all the different pictures and tables and say, look, you see, it doesn't hurt if the discount rate goes up some. It doesn't hurt if your reinvestment rate goes down some. Whatever. It's still a good project. That's the strength of having your plan of action before you walk in. 6 years ago, we go into competitions with other schools, universities around the country for new projects, and they go before a panel of judges, and the judges decide what projects are good, what projects are not good, and the winner gets financing. The winning team from a university gets the money to go ahead. It's sort of like Shark Tank, and we do that. Well, before we let a team go to any national competition or regional competition, we have these teams come to us as judges to see which one of the teams is going to work the best for it. And you would be amazed at the variation in the quality of the product, in the quality that comes out, that comes into those. Teams come in, some of them come in with an idea, and they stand there and they talk about their idea, and they throw around some fancy terms and they don't show any numbers. Other teams come in with a very flat analysis, maybe something like this, and once in a while you have a team that just blows you away. That's what we want to see. That's what you would do in the real world, and that's what's going to happen when you face a panel of judges in a national competition. And so it starts right here where we have these expectations. In one case, we had a competition. We have the possibility of, if projects are good and young people have, you know, give us a good show, we do have investors in the area, angels, what are called angel investors, and financing institutions that are willing to look at what we professors think are good ideas. Have a look at these. And once in a while, those work out and something great happens. Does anyone know a company that is relatively successful right now that started here at ISU, and I saw the team and I was one of the advisors when it happened? Yeah? No, I wish. I mean, I would have bought stock back then. But yeah, they actually came before us and they did a dog and pony show, but it wasn't students. But Backpack? Uh-huh, yeah. They started right here and they started with a dog and pony show and they had their major act together. Right there and then, they had the numbers. They had their competitors. They did the SWOT analysis, and all that kind of stuff, spreadsheets, charts, and all of that. And when they went to the heavy leagues, they had it together, and they won. They blew them away with it, and that's what you have to do. Even if you're never going to do a competition, if you're the hero in a company that brings a project to them and you have all of your act together and it succeeds, well, there you go. You're set for life. You are on your way to the executive suites. Of course, if it fails, then you're in the mailroom for the rest of your life. So there's that. But let me give you something about technologies and transitional technologies and where mistakes can be made. A company that is actually now multinational in the U.S. and Canada. It used to be just a relatively minor regional player right here in this area of the country, has been expanding over the last 20 years, and they have grown, I think, 37 states and locations in Canada. They are on the move upward. Now, they have divisions within the company. It's oddly formed because essentially, the company is a collection of farm cooperatives, co-ops. And these cooperatives get services provided, the seed, fertilizer, transportation, logistics, insurance, all that, through the holding, kind of like a holding company, the owner of all of the co-ops together. So you have that kind of divisionalism. But of course, you also have the divisionalism of, there's a division that does the fertilizers, a division that does the seeds, a division that does the insurance and the pensions for the farmers and the co-ops and all that kind of stuff. So it's got an odd kind of matrix of things you could look at. Okay, here's what happened. One regional division decided that they were going to go full on and they were going to replace all of their driver-driven commercial vehicles with self-driving vehicles. Essentially robot, the robot stuff. Driving down the highways with all the stuff in them, and you wouldn't have to worry about those drivers and taking breaks and silliness like that, and you wouldn't have to worry about pensions and health care. Boy, was this going to be a great idea. Look at all the savings. Look at those freaking NPV replacements, the replacement project NPVs. I mean, it was just awesome. Replace all these old fossil fuel-driven, truck driver-driven vehicles with these self-driving vehicles. Couple of problems, and not fortunately, because they'd already gone full on into it. Turned out that no one had checked to see if there were states that allowed this, what states did. Not every state in the union, in fact, not very many states will allow self-driven commercial vehicles on their roads. Second of all, these vehicles will tend to platoon. In other words, they line up, and then there's the lead like the pilot, and they all follow the pilot on the lead. Well, what happens if the pilot makes a mistake? More importantly, if they're carrying fertilizers, you're talking about toxic substances. One accident, the platoon goes into a full-blown crash, multi-vehicle crash, and then you have not just an environmental mess and a tragedy, you have an insane cost for remediation of the disaster that has happened. Take a thought. If you know anything about anhydrous ammonia, which is poured on fields in the spring to bind for the nitrates and all that good stuff, if anhydrous, even when you are laying that on fields, you cannot have a wind, because if the wind picks up the anhydrous, it'll kill a forest and wipe out people in the path of the stuff. the hilarious thing, anhydrous ammonia is also used in the manufacture of illegal drugs like crack cocaine. So they used to have a problem down here with the kids from Chicago coming down and going into the fields where the nurse tanks had it. They'd just fill up buckets and put it in their cars and drive up to Chicago, and they'd find the corpses of the kids along the road on the way up there because they died from the anhydrous fumes. But anyway, the point here was they didn't think to check, well, do states allow this? No. Well, we'll just tell the states we need this, and the states are going to say, no, we've already analyzed the risk structure. We don't want this stuff until you can be a whole hell of a lot more certain about the outcomes than you are right now. So there was first a place that shot down. Then the insurance. Okay, in an accident with platooned non-human drivers, you've got a disaster on the highway waiting to happen. Okay, so there you go. Be careful of these great ideas and new technologies replacing old technologies. It turns out you see those old fossil fuel-driven vehicles, they're going to last for at least another 10 years. And until a technology comes along that has a much greater certainty, much less standalone risk under what-ifs, then it's probably going to be a good idea not to go too far into a new technology. The results can turn out to be rather catastrophic. Anyway, a lesson for the day, and that's all I have for you. I'll see you on Friday. Thank you.